Okay, so welcome. Tonight we will be focusing on the second discourse of the Buddha. Now, these discourses are actually, if we study them directly, they can be a bit difficult for the uninitiated, because we're dealing with, remember, the suttas are directed towards a specific audience. In this case, some pretty hardcore meditators, the five ascetics, and the third discourse is to a set of different ascetics. So at the very least, we have to understand that these aren't general how to live your life in the world sort of talks. These are very much the core of how to become truly free from suffering, how to find true peace and happiness. They're not supposed to be painful or grueling. They're not long and arduous and hard to understand. They're short and concise and hard to understand. But they're hard to understand for another reason. They're hard to understand because you need to be a meditator to understand them. So I'm assuming that some people here are not strong or experienced in meditation, and so we'll take it a bit light. And we're not going to delve deeply into the meaning of the sutta. Instead, we're going to talk about the ideas in the sutta and the principles and try to apply them to our practice. The Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the characteristic of non-self, poses another problem, and that's that it brings up this monster teaching of non-self, which in many ways is another characteristic teaching of the Buddha, something that is unique to Buddhism, you might say, because the idea of a soul or a self is quite central to the majority of other religions, other major religions, I think. And so to go the other way and to talk about non-self starts to, it shakes you up, really. And that is, in a way, in a sense, the reason for teaching non-self, to shake us up, to take us out of our delusions. And I really mean that, take us out of our delusions, and this is important to understand. Because we have this question, is there a self? Do I have a soul? Do you mean to tell me that the Buddha taught that there is no soul, there is no self? And we actually don't have these words recorded as being words of the Buddha, there is no self. The closest we come is the Buddha said, I tell you, monks, hold on tightly to any view of self, that when you hold on to that view, it doesn't bring you suffering. And he asked the monks, do you see such a view? And they said, no he tang bante, mai chai pa chau kha. No, venerable sir, we don't see such a view. Mai hin. And the Buddha said, very good, because I also don't see such a view. And for this reason I say, discard any view of self. And this wording is important. It actually, some people go too far with the wording and think, the Buddha left room for a self, and the idea that there could be a self, he left room for it. He never said there isn't one. He kind of skirted around the issue, it seems. But And this is my interpretation. So the Buddha didn't say this as well, but my understanding of it, and it's quite clear, really. The way to understand how the Buddha approached the idea of non-self, the idea of determinism, free will, and many other, what do you call them, philosophical, metaphysical ideas, concepts. Is to place them on another level of existence. Actually, outside of existence. So the question, when we talk about self, the question we have to answer is, what really exists? What is this? Can anyone tell me? It's a fist. Right? Right now in front of you there's a fist. Where'd the fist go? Where'd it go? It's gone. It never existed. The fist is a concept. When this appears in front of you, your brain has a little neat little function that it's like an app. Recognizes an OCR or whatever you say. Recognition module. If that module is broken, you can't recognize the fist. When I hold this up, what do you see? Can anyone see my hand? The correct answer is no. No one can see my hand. It's not possible to see my hand. What do you see? No, you can't see fingers either. What do you see? You can see Nam?
No.
What do you see?
Rub.
Rub. And what sort of rub do you see?
Of your,
of my hand?
Of you.
No. No, in fact, you don't. What did you say? No. You're not going to get it. What if I turn off the lights? Do you see the hand? So what are you actually seeing? You're seeing the light. It's quite simple. It's not a Buddhist answer, exactly. That's not even a Buddhist concept. You really do see the light. Right? Science will tell you as much. You don't actually... The only way you can perceive my hand is if I hit you with it. Then, yes, then you're feeling my hand, in some sense.
Then I have a self.
I got myself bounced out the door, probably. But it's a good example. These are good examples for helping us, reminding ourselves that the way we perceive the world is not how it is. The way we perceive the world generally, ordinarily, is not how it is. And that causes lots of problems. Because if all you saw was light, then you wouldn't be turned off by seeing my ugly face. I'd walk in the door and you wouldn't be turned off by it. Or someone would shout nasty words at you and you'd say, oh, it's some sound has arisen. But we don't do that. You see, we take the words and the sentences and the meanings and the context behind those things to be real. And this causes us problems. Not that they're not useful, but we're not able to distinguish. We're not able to turn that off or to step outside of it. So we get caught in this. When someone yells nasty words at us, we freak out. We get angry and we want to hit someone. The teachings of the Buddha are for the purpose of bringing us back to the most basic level of what is real, of what really exists. The fist doesn't exist. My hand doesn't exist. The cells don't exist. Atoms don't exist. Subatomic particles don't even exist. We don't know whether they're particles or waves. We don't know whether they exist here, now, or everywhere, or if it's just a potentiality. We don't really know. Quantum physics is kind of this weird, wacky thing that no one really understands. And it's real, So the question is, what really exists? It's kind of makes you despair a little bit. Well, then we can't really know that anything exists. The truth is, you can. But there's very little that you can. And I'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow when we talk about what really exists. But when the Buddha began the first discourse, he talked about the truth of suffering, and he said, in brief, all that we can put together as being suffering, and in fact all that exists in the universe, it comes down to five things. Some people know what these five things are. The five aggregates, the five khandhas. Sankhitena panchupadana kandha dukha. In brief, the truth of suffering, meaning anything that can cause us suffering, is under these five aggregates. In other words, really, anything that exists in the universe, outside of Nibbana, apart from Nirvana, everything else is in the five aggregates. And that's what he taught in the second discourse, which we're supposed to be discussing tonight. And so he didn't go outside of this, you see. And more than that, from a Buddhist point of view, that's all that exists. These five aggregates, which are rupnam, which are experience. I don't want to get too technical here, so I'm not going to go through what are the five aggregates, not... maybe in brief we will, but basically rup nam, nama rupa, which means the knowing and the object of, that's being known. And even briefer, experience. From a Buddhist point of view, what really exists is experience. Okay? Many people look at this and they say the Buddha was just practical. It's not that he taught there was or wasn't a self, he avoided it. That's not useful. I'd go another step and I'd say the universe agrees with the Buddha, that this idea of a self, the idea of free will and determinism, they're incompatible with reality. They're outside of reality. In order to talk about free will, you need a self. You need an entity that has free will. In order to talk about determinism, you need entities that are deterministic. And all of these entities are like the hand and the fist and so on. They arise in the mind. Their only way of existing is through a concept. Apart from seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking, everything else is something that we've dreamed up and written down and calculated about. And it's all been blown apart by the very teachings that it was supposed to have, that were supposed to have verified it. So from a Buddhist point of view, reality is experience. That's all there is. Momentary experience that arises and ceases, and it's based on these five aggregates. So when we talk about non-self, we don't talk about whether there is a self or isn't a self. We talk about it being a characteristic of all experience. And this is important because it's practical, because it's useful for us. It's something that we can take away and carry forward with us in our practice, something that is going to help us to let go, help us to give up our attachments and our stresses and our obsessions with those things that we think are me, are mine, are myself. And so this is how the Buddha starts. The Buddha starts by unequivocally saying that form is not self. He's not giving them an opportunity to debate it. He says, form is not self. Why? Form means really everything that we think of as physical, body. It's the physical aspect of experience. And remember, these guys have been meditating they've been torturing themselves for a long time, but they've been meditating here with the Buddha for about 5 days straight, right under the tutelage of the Buddha. And so they're really getting into this. They've all become what we call sotapanna. So they've all really got the gist of the Buddha's teaching and seen Nibbana, actually, seen Nirvana for the first time. So they're really into this idea of seeing things experientially, that what really exists is our seeing, right? I mean, close your eyes and ask yourself, what really arises? Sometimes you see things, even with your eyes closed, you'll have visions. Sometimes you hear, smell, taste, feel, or think. This is what exists. Every time you see or hear or smell or taste or feel, every time you have an experience, there is the physical aspect of it and there is the mental aspect of it. The physical aspect is what we call rupa. So when I said, what do you see when you see my hand? You see the light. That's the physical aspect of experience, of that experience. When you hear the sound in the ear, these are the physical aspects. When you smell, it's the scent and the nose. When you taste, it's the tongue and the food, or the flavor in the food. When you feel something on the body, it's my fist in your face. It's this cushion, right? And your bottom touching the cushion. Or it's the stiffness in your back, or it's the heat in the room. This is also the feelings in the body. And an ordinary person, most of the time we think of this as being here. We think there's a temperature in this room. This room has a certain heat or lack of heat to it. So for some people it's too hot in this room, for some people it's maybe too cold in this room. And we think, we ask, what is the temperature in the room? And we can all figure out what that is. But in actual fact, all of this is conceptual in your mind. The only time there's cold in this room is when you feel that cold, and that feeling arises and ceases. The Buddha said, it's non-self. He said, it's not two things. One, it's not an entity. And two, it's not under our control. And he said, the reason why it's not, or he said his proof anyway that it's not, is because it's not amenable to our will. If it was self, then it wouldn't cause us suffering. So the idea of a self that people get, which, as we said, is actually conceptual. It's nothing to do with experience. It's nothing to do with the ultimate reality. Is the idea that this is me and this is mine, that there's someone in control. They said, well, if that's true, then it wouldn't... Is it possible that this would cause us suffering? And this is the first part of the sutta. The first part of the sutta, he lays out his theory that these things are non-self. In the second part, he goes on, which is a little more interesting, to actually ask the monks. He said, okay, maybe you don't believe me. If I tell you that form is not self, if I tell you that your feelings are not self, your memories and your perception are not self. Maybe you disagree with me. Your consciousness, your thoughts, your emotions, all of these things we say, they're not really you. So he said, well, okay, let me ask you this. Rupang bhikkhave nityang va anityang va ti. Is form permanent or is it impermanent? And so before I ask this question, this is why I wanted to put a little bit of introduction to the discourse. To help you understand, what do we mean by is form permanent or even, let's not say permanent, let's say lasting. Because if you take this clock as being part of being made up of form, made up of rupa, then how long has this clock been here? It's been here for at least a half an hour. That we consider to be lasting, you see. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, was the clock there for a half an hour? And the only way we can answer that is if we agree on our understanding of what exists. From a Buddhist point of view, the clock doesn't exist. It's not sitting there. The idea of the clock arises in the mind because light touches the eye. Now that, and at the moment of the light touching the eye, there is an awareness of that contact. Just for that moment, that experience arises. When that experience arises, in the mind arises the idea of the clock. This is actually carried out or is held up, seems to be quite in line with modern scientific thinking, that this idea of if you're not aware of something, there's this cat in the box and he's both alive and dead. Until someone goes, the point being, you can't even talk about that cat until you introduce the measuring device or the experimenter in this case. So I don't want to fall into this category of quantum physics supports Buddhism kind of thing, but there's certainly a problem with this idea of the clock being there. Because you can't even talk about it from scientific point of view until you have a framework of someone looking at the clock. And this is, they looked at these particles and I don't know, I don't really understand it, but they've got this idea of you need an observer, depending on who you talk to. But this is exactly what we say in Buddhism, regardless of what modern scientists and all their nonsense say. In Buddhism, you need an observer. Whether the clock, in some sense, is there or not, it's quite useful for us to think that the clock is there. It's, on some level, its existence is essential. Otherwise, I can't figure out what time it is. Right? But on a Buddhist meditation level, on an ultimate level, it doesn't exist. And there's a problem with us thinking that these things exist because they become entities for us. So when a person yells at me, says something nasty to me, I keep that in my mind and I think that person said those nasty words to me. It's an entity for me. It's there. It's lasting, you see. I've given it life. It didn't have life. That sound arose and ceased. The Buddha said, "Rupang bhikkhave nityang va anicchang va." Is it permanent or impermanent? And they answered, "Anicchang bhante." But the only reason they answered that, the only reason they could answer that, is because they'd seen through this. They'd seen through the idea that the clock is sitting there. They'd seen through the idea that a person actually yelled those words at me. They came to see that the truth is that there's sound. You think I'm giving this talk for a long time. The truth is, sound is arising at your ear, and it's arising and ceasing. If you want, you can start meditating on the sound of my voice. Just use this word, say to yourself, hearing, hearing, hearing. It's quite disconcerting. It's a difficult thing to do. It's not quite a comfortable exercise because you can't anticipate my sound because the sound is non-self. Now, obviously, it's not your sound, so you know it's not self. It's not me speaking. But your mind doesn't know that. Your mind has a hard time with that. It wants to be able to anticipate. This is why music, apparently, this is why they say music is so wonderful to us. Why we like music? To spoil the whole magic of it. It's simply because we enjoy the ability to predict and the excitement of being able to predict and being surprised and so on. Not being able to predict something is actually stressful. It's disconcerting when we're expecting one thing and something else comes. Obviously, this is a great cause for suffering for us. The inability to predict. We have expectations. people around us, we expect them to behave in certain ways. Our jobs, our societies, we expect nature to always be there for us, and we expect our phones to always work and our computers to always work. We expect things, so many things, and this is why we suffer, because our expectations are unfulfilled, are unfulfillable. Why is that? Because the truth of the matter is these things don't exist. All that exists is, what exists really is this impermanent flux of experience. You can't predict someone whether they're going to yell at you or not. Obviously, this is part of the meaning of non-self. That's actually a scary part of reality, is that you can't predict, right? So it sounds actually quite depressing. You think, wow, there goes my whole life, really. All that I thought was stable, you're telling me it's... You're trying to tell me, and I'm not going to have it, that my life, everything in my life is unstable. I can't find stability. My house is non-self, my car, my job, all of these things are... that seem so stable are actually unstable, and it can actually be quite depressing. And in fact, if you haven't found a meditation teaching, these sorts of ideas can cause people to lose their sense of meaning in life. It's actually an important first step on the path. But it's important first step because it actually leads, it's quite an uplifting teaching. Because there is something there. What is really there is this sound. This person yelling at you actually has no power to hurt you. It's not you. It's not an entity. Right? It could just be birds chirping. Rupang bhikkave nicchang va nicchang vati. So they were able to see through that. They were able to see that what really exists is just experience. When you feel pain in the body, vedana bhikkave nicchang va nicchang vati. Is pain in the body, is it permanent? Is it lasting or is it stable or unstable? Or happiness? Is happiness stable or unstable? And the Buddha said, no, it's unstable. Meaning when you sit here and you think you have pain in your body, pain in your legs, pain in your back, or so on, that in fact this pain it doesn't really belong to you. It's not really... an entity. It's something that arises as an experience and ceases. Anyway, so this is, I've gone on a little bit long about the idea of non-self. What I really wanted to talk about is how this relates to our practice. How do we practice? So this is actually how it's an uplifting sort of teaching. Because the problem with these concepts is that they really make for a bummer in your meditation. When we come to practice meditation, we want to find peace and happiness. And for most people, this means taking the shortcut of sitting and blissing out. So you want to be able to sit and find great peace and happiness, which is a great thing to be able to do. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's something missing from simply sitting and trying to savor the enjoyable aspects of reality. And is that we've got a problem, that the very nature of reality is impermanent. And so when we break through to the nature of reality, we actually come to see that it's quite unpleasant. That everything that we held to be stable, everything that we held to be a cause of comfort for us, is no longer a refuge, is no longer a support. It's quite difficult. It's not a not a very comfortable thing to approach. When you'll be sitting here and you'll think, okay, this was fun for a while, but then the pain arises or the temperature changes or your mind starts to change and you start to think about something else. It's quite difficult to deal with. Our inclination is to run away from the unpleasant aspects of existence. Our inclination is to try to segregate and to separate reality out into that which is acceptable and that which is unacceptable. And this is really unacceptable. Because it doesn't work, you see. It's untenable. It's unsustainable. If you want to take meditation like a drug, then it winds up being just like a drug. Something that gives you a temporary sense of relief from suffering. But does nothing for you in the long run, absolutely. In fact, if anything, creates an addiction. Now, the addiction to meditation isn't a bad addiction, I wouldn't say. But that's all it is. And when you quit, there's nothing sustained. And the world around you, the universe around you, it still has all of this underlying impermanent suffering and non-suffering. And this is really the key, is that you can run away from it as much as you want. The problem is that it's the essence of reality. Underlying everything is the nature of impermanent suffering and non-self. So when people come to practice meditation or Buddhist meditation, it's often an uncomfortable experience. As an experience that people will shy away from. When people enter into the practice of insight meditation particularly, they tend often to come back to the idea that they're practicing incorrectly, or worse, that this sort of practice is an incorrect sort of practice. They think that I must be doing something wrong because it's quite unpleasant. Sitting here right now, there's a lot that's wrong, right? There's the pains in our bodies, the itching and uncomfortable sensations, our mental, the patience that we have to have with ourselves being sitting still. And when you close your eyes and begin to look at the body, if you start to watch the breath or the watch the five aggregates, you see, watch the body, watch the mind. When you really start to watch it, you see how out of control it is. It's very impermanent, changing all the time. Unpleasant, it's not the way we want it to be. People will come often to the teacher and complain about this. I must be doing something wrong, my mind is all over the place. I must be doing something wrong because I've got pains and I acknowledge them and no matter how much I'm with them, they never go away. I think I just can't meditate. And I, no matter what I do, I can't control either my body or my mind. I can't, the breath, I'm watching the breath and it's totally out of control. I'm watching my mind and my mind, I'm like a crazy person. And they'll come and they'll say something's wrong. And in a sense, they're right. What's wrong is our expectations. Our understanding of reality is quite skewed. And that we think in terms of clocks, we think in terms of entities, people. why couples have such problems is because of expectations. It's the exact thing that we're talking about. When a husband and a wife fight, or brothers and sisters, parents and children, we look at our children, and when they grow, I don't have children, but when you have children, you look at them, and they're so cute and so wonderful, and you get all these expectations. You don't consciously expect, but you cultivate the idea that your child is so beautiful and wonderful and peaceful and cuddly and cute and just the perfect little angel. That creates expectations. When the child becomes a screaming, raging ball of hate and anger and viciousness, you kind of get upset. And we do this with everything in our lives because of our expectations, because of the way we look at the world. We look at the world in terms of entities that are permanent or stable, that are pleasant, a source of comfort for us, and that are controllable, that we can arrange to our liking. And so we approach our meditation in this way. Meditation is fine as long as it's stable, pleasant, and controllable. So we take all these types of meditation that rely on control, being able to control the breath, control your body to be able to sit very still, control your mind to be very quiet. And it really misses the point that the Buddha didn't even go in that direction. When he talked to these monks, he said what he was aiming for is to help them to see impermanent suffering and non-self. And so the truth is, when you see your body and your mind changing, when you see the thoughts coming and going in your mind, this chaotic jumble and mess, you're seeing reality. When you see your mind going in directions that you'd rather it didn't, and your body giving rise to pains and aches that you'd rather it didn't, and when you see that you can't control both either your body or your mind, you're seeing reality. You're seeing what the Buddha would have us see. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the world. It you know, when someone yells in your ear, calls you all sorts of nasty names, there's nothing wrong with that. It's an uplifting teaching because the experience is in and of themselves, impermanent suffering and non-self. What's the problem? The problem is that we have expectations. We expect otherwise. We have these delusions. We have the idea that it's otherwise. The truth is, once you see these horrible things, see that everything is impermanent, what a horrible thought. Once you see that, then the whole world is your oyster. There's nothing that could possibly hurt you or cause you suffering. Once you see that there's nothing that's going to please you, that there's nothing that you can hold on to as lasting, not a person or a place or a thing, then you can be anywhere. Your happiness doesn't rely upon objects. And when you see that nothing is under your control, you stop trying to control things. You stop expecting things to go your way. You stop trying to force. You stop reacting to everything. You just let things be as they are. In fact, you reject them all. You reject the clock. It's not going to bring me happiness. There's nothing good about that clock. If I need to know what time it is, I just know what time it is. I'm not going to take that home with me. I don't see anything attractive about this, you see. We stop trying to find happiness in the world around us. We stop clinging. And we become invincible. We become able to deal with absolutely anything. You see, this is what the power of science of the subatomic particles. You see, once you know what matter is made of, You can blow it up and kill lots of people. You have a great power, atomic energy. It comes from understanding what things are made of. Once you understand what the universe is made of, in a Buddhist sense, what experience is made of, then the whole world, all every experience is under control, in a sense. Safe. And so this is the sort of idea that the Buddha taught in this. I've gone far over time, but to end off, just to explain how this fits in, the Buddha taught in this way. He really wanted for his monks to let go. This was the idea. So in the end of the sutta, he says, when a person sees these things, then they let go. They become dispassionate. So they lose their attachment for the beauty of the clock and the ugliness of my face. And so we lose our intoxication with things. And when we do, we become free. When we're free, we say we're free. And this is really all there is to the Buddha's teaching. This was the teaching, this idea of impermanence, non-suffering and non-self that the Buddha taught, that allowed the five monks to free themselves completely from suffering and to become arahant, which is fully enlightened beings. So anyway, it's a tough subject. I hope I've done it some justice, and thank you for your patience. If you have questions, I can stay for as long as people have patience and questions.
Okay, thank you, Venerable. Can you just say in English what was actually said in the sutta? In like a minute to...
So basically the Buddha, he starts off by saying that the five aggregates, which are the body, feelings, memories, thoughts, in the sense of not just thoughts, but thoughts like what you think of things, your judgments and so on, and consciousness. Basically body and mind, let's not get too technical. Body and mind are non-self. He said if they were self, then they wouldn't lead you to suffer, basically. And you'd be able to control them. And then he starts saying, okay, so if you don't believe me, let me ask you, are they impermanent? And they said they're impermanent. If they're impermanent, then are they stressful or a cause for pleasure? Are they going to make you happy? And they said, no, they're not going to make us happy, because you can't rely on them. If your happiness is dependent on that, good luck, because it's a roll of the dice. And then he said, well, in that case, is it proper to say that they're me, mine, myself? And they said, no, in that case it's not. Even if they were, it would be ridiculous to want that. It's not something that you'd want them to be, because then you're dragging around this thing that's uncertain and stressful.
So to bring up an example, if you're feeling sick in the body can't be yourself. Otherwise, you wouldn't, because you don't want your body to be sick.
Yeah.
So you would be able to, if it was yourself, you'd be able to change it.
Yeah.
Because the body is doing things that you don't want, it suggests that this body is not myself. Also, this body, the feelings, they're not permanent, they're always changing. And because they're always changing, they're a form of suffering, or at least instability, sense of suffering, instability. Yeah. Okay. So, are there any questions or comments, or anything you'd like to expand on a little bit? Yeah.
So, when you reach that point, you realize that it's not only expectations, that you realize that having another job is not really important, or having more money is not really the point. So what then, what is then the main of your main quest in life? Is there such a thing?
No more questing.
Okay, so the question is,
what would be your quest? Purpose.
Okay.
What's the purpose of life? What's the meaning of life then?
So just to repeat for the people at the back who can't hear you, he's saying if you're giving up all your expectations, what is the purpose of your life?
What should you do?
What do you do next? Just whatever you're used to doing. That's really it. An enlightened being doesn't just sit around in a puddle of their own urine and feces. They do whatever they're used to doing, whatever they're accustomed to doing. It's just functional. They just live. And the meaning is they do what all of us think that we do. We think we're just living. Truth is, we're not. We're all over the place, chasing after this, chasing after that. Once all that's gone, then we just live. And that's it. When we die, we just die. That's it. We're free. I mean, it's actually, the problem with that is it's so hard. I mean, that's the top of the mountain. What we know is that a lot of this questing anyway, is just causing us suffering. Our chasing after sensual pleasures we've got to do something about it, you see, because it's destroying the planet, if nothing else. It's destroying us. It destroys families, it destroys friendships, why relationships break up, it's all, there's just too much heat, too much crazy. The mind just goes, it's a fever. So we know that there's some things that we have to, that's why we're here. We're here because we have suffering in our lives. So we're trying to find out the cause of that and help to alleviate it. So all of this teaching is just for that. Problem is it's like a woolen sweater. You have a loose thread, so you pull on it. And before you know it, you're standing there naked. Because it just keeps going. So one thing leads to another, and it's like a cult. You get pulled in and you can never leave. Buddhism is open ayiko. It leads you on. It's, in a sense, but not in the English sense. It leads you further. So the more you practice, the more you want to practice. In the beginning, you come here because maybe you got a backache or you got headaches, and you know, how do I deal with this? And in the end, you become a monk and go off and live in the forest because you realize the headache was just the thread, the loose thread. And there's a much deeper underlying problem.
I think you just scared them all that they're going to become monks now.
I should inspire you to become monks. Come to Canada, I'll ordain you all.
Who's going to feed
you? I'll feed you.
Okay, you have a question?
Can you talk about non-attachment and compassion?
Mm-hmm.
Or even non-attachment and the Eightfold Path? Because it seems like, you know, you talk about habits of being just habits, and they're either good or bad, because everything is arising. Like some of the core tenets of Buddhism have to do with how we live during that rising and falling of life.
So just to summarize the question, the attachment and compassion, the idea being if you're non-attached, how are you going to be compassionate for beings?
How do you live a compassionate life if you're non-attached?
First of all, compassion isn't part of the Eightfold Noble Path. We have to understand this. Compassion is a great thing, but it's actually not core. First thing I want to say, because otherwise people get the idea that we're trying to become more compassionate. It's actually not such a big deal in Buddhism. The Buddha had great compassion in Theravada Buddhism. I'm sorry. So you're talking to a Theravada Buddhist monk. In the scheme of things, and I would say in Mahayana they will... Well, I don't know, actually. Probably not. In order to become free from suffering, you see, it's not something you need to focus on. And I will stand by that, because an enlightened person has perfect compassion. They are never uncompassionate. Now, they might not go out of their way to save the world, but they are unable to be uncompassionate. The key to compassion is when you see someone who's suffering, you help them. Now, for an enlightened person, that's functional. That's a part of nature. To deny someone your help requires ignorance and attachment.
Isn't that a moral judgment? You see someone who's suffering, they're
when they tell you they're suffering. When a person says, hey, look, can you help me? I've fallen and I can't get up. Pick them up.
And you say, no, I'm not attached.
In fact, if they say, look, can you give me your kidney? You say, here's my kidney. Maybe not all the time, but you're not, you have no attachment to your kidney. If they need it, you want it.
No. But what are you doing when you're not?
Just don't take my iPhone.
You're being what people would call compassionate.
But that compassion has no
meaning. What compassion is not is sadness or sorrow for other people. That's not compassion. That's actually anger. I mean anger, actually. I mean when you feel sad for someone, when you get emotional about it, that doesn't help them. When they say, oh, poor you, that's not compassion. That's actually, see, from on an ultimate level, that's an attachment. That's actually causing you suffering, stress. It's not helping you help them. You don't help them better because you pity them or because you feel sad for them or so on.
So you're saying that an enlightened being naturally approaches the world with compassion.
Great compassion.
Great compassion.
Perfect compassion.
It's possible that you could practice compassion for all the wrong reasons because you want to create an image of yourself.
Mostly we practice compassion because we feel sad. And so it's kind of a...
We can't accept the suffering in the other person.
Yeah.
We don't like that feeling.
Yeah. We get angry, in fact. People who work for non-profits trying to save the world can be very angry people.
It's interesting that when you do counseling in psychology, or even doctors, when they're giving you bad news, that we're taught not to be engaging in those emotions. So you can be compassionate, but you're supposed to be logical and not get caught up in the emotions of the other person.
The problem
this will help the other person.
The problem and the reason why we like compassion and love and we think of them as such good Buddhist things is because they're all warm and fuzzy and they make us feel good, which is not really the point.
So what is the point of being
cold? Cold and hard, not warm and fuzzy.
We're free. We're cool. Siti Buddha means we've become cool. What's the point of the Eightfold Noble Path? The Eightfold Noble Path is to become free from suffering. It's the path, it's called the Dukkha Nirodha Gamini Patipata, the path that leads to the cessation of suffering.
If I can give an example of something
really.
That did happen with me, that a few years ago I had a misdiagnosis and I was told I had cancer. And it was wrong, I'm okay, but I've been trained in psychology to give counseling. So I can see exactly the way the doctor is doing it. And the way the doctor approaches it is this is totally calm. He has no attachment. If he's attached to me, he's getting caught up with me emotionally. So I'm starting, my vision's going white and I'm starting to feel dizzy. And he's saying, okay, now there's a process to this, etc., blah, 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 blah. So he's dealing with me in a non-attached way, which is really the most compassionate thing you can do.
Yeah.
If he's going to start feeling sorry for me, or start getting caught up in my tears, or something like that, that might be a kind of compassionate and feeling tone, but he's really not helping me that much. So doctors and psychologists are trained to deal with people in a non-attached way, because it's the most compassionate way to actually help somebody.
And a thousand times more important as a meditation teacher.
Yeah.
I had a woman who was raped by her father. And she was 40 years old, came to me, and she had been raped by her father when she was young. And she looked like a ghost. Her hair's in her face and white like a sheet and hobbling. She was a mess. Her whole physique, you could just see something. And I didn't know what was wrong. And I never asked her. And it bugged her that I never asked her, because she was crying and she'd come to me and say to herself, crying, sad. And totally, a thousand, if you ever teach meditation, you see this so clearly. When you're dealing with people's minds, the worst thing you can do is to start get caught up and for example, feel sad for them. So we went through this, and at the end of her course, at one point she was so frustrated, you could see it, because just ask me already, what's wrong, right? Because she's so used to people wanting to know what's wrong and tell her story. And I didn't know her story for like 3 weeks. And then she finished her course and finally told me, it came up, and I said, so, you know, what was wrong? And she told me, and we talked about it, and she said, it's amazing how great she felt. She went away, she came back a couple of weeks later to do an advanced course, and a totally different person. Color in her face, her vision clear, and like alive again. Anyway, that's not a little bit off topic, but the essence there is the objectivity. It sounds dry, and you lose so much of what we cling to as being the spice of life, the fruit of the zest of life. But it's actually it's the rotten stuff.
Okay, we just have a few minutes, so short question, short answer. Clifton?
So suffering then can be the result of the term we talked about, sakkaditti.
Sakkaditti.
Where a person identifies with their conditioned self.
We've only got a few minutes left.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know if I'd qualify it with the word conditioned. If you identify with self in any way, shape, or form, you're always going to suffer. There's no way that you can cling to self that I know of, or even that the Buddha knew of.
You say, I'm an American, I'm a college graduate,
yeah.
I'm a Republican,
uh-huh.
etc. Then that's the source for suffering. Right?
No, when you say it, this is...
Yes. Because I think these guys didn't hear. If you say, I am a college graduate, or I am this or that, that's a source of suffering. And then he's checking if that statement is correct.
No, it's called vohara. It's a manner of speaking. The Buddha used it. The Buddha said, I'm a Buddha. You know, and he said, but I know what those words mean. I know that that's just words. It's when you cling to that. When you say, I am an American, and you pound your chest and hold up a flag, and when that feeling in your heart arises, how good you feel when you see the American flag, that is going to cause you suffering. Absolutely. And
okay.
It's a horrible thing in the world, this patriotism.
A couple of short questions, short answer, last few minutes. You had a question? Hamish?
A very quick question. You mentioned that present experience is somehow the fundamental nature which one is seeking to understand.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's the English word experience, but if experience consists of the object and what that object causes to arise, where is the arising taking place?
Okay, so the question is about experience. Where is experience arising?
Again, I would say these both of those questions are abstractions. We assume that there must be answers to them because we assume that the universe somehow works that way, somehow relies on a fundamental underlying framework of space-time. And Buddhism doesn't accept such a fundamental underlying foundation. And as I said, as far as I can see, physics doesn't seem to have a very good hold on it either. Materialists have this, it's materialism or physicalism, the idea that there's an underlying who, what, when, how, you know, a three-dimensional or four-dimensional space-time. You need that sort of thing to be able to talk about where. But there may not be such a where. What we know, we don't know that. I don't know the answer to that. I'm postulating that it's not a part of reality.
It's the wrong question, maybe.
It's the wrong question. What we know is that it arises. The where does it arise? You know, that question kind of, it's like quacking of a duck. It arises. Who experiences it? Is again, it's like a quacking of a duck. I don't know. You know, like what did that question means nothing to me. It
is
arises.
It the quacking or the back end?
Quacking.
Quacking of a duck.
Sorry, my speech teacher over here. The quacking
I thought
of
you said the
duck.
Back end of a duck, and I'm trying to
you
think
see.
Of that.
And
okay, just one last.
I wanted to go back to your initial statement of the Buddhist teaching on non-self. And
mm-hmm.
I think you said that, paraphrasing, that the Buddha said that there's no view of self that won't cause suffering.
He couldn't find one. There isn't one.
So to me, that sounds like kind of an agnosticism on the issue of,
yeah,
there's no view you can hold about the self that's not going to cause suffering.
Right.
But to me, that is not a metaphysical position on mm-hmm. whether self exists or not.
Uh-huh.
But then mm-hmm. I think you continued and you then said, I think you said, but I believe the Buddha was taking a metaphysical position. So I just want to clarify that.
The Buddha is the Buddha taking a metaphysical position on self? My view, my position is that all of those metaphysical ideas don't have any, are like the quacking of a duck. They have no place in reality. The idea of the existence of a self is wrong. It's like the fist. It's a concept that arises in your mind. It's just a concept. So if we say, does a self exist, doesn't a self exist, it's the wrong question. Experience exists. Experience, entities don't have a place in reality.
Okay, last question in the back. Yes.
Zombies eating
Did
people's
you all hear
flesh.
The question? Okay, she's saying, with all these kind of teachings of non-attachment, no expectations, it sounds like we would all live as zombies without happiness, and then we die.
What about the people who do live as zombies every day today? Are they not the same people who are chasing after these sensual pleasures? The plebeians who, well, all of us, you know, not us excluded, but all of the us who just go out and work every day. These are the zombies. It's a criticism that Buddhism faces. It's actually totally untrue. Why is it that those who have left behind sensual pleasures are the most happy, radiant, peaceful people? There's a weight to all of this. The problem is there's a weight to sensual pleasures. There's a heaviness to it. It weighs you down. There's a fire to it. It burns you up. There's a sickness to it. It makes you sick. It pickles your mind. It destroys your sense of judgment and clarity and center. Anything that you cling to is going to burn you up and destroy you and really weigh you down, turn you into a zombie. And that's why we see a lot of zombies out there, you know, pludging along. Why do people go to a 9-to-5 job? Why do people work all day? Mostly because they want their iPhones. They want their sensual plan. They want something. Maybe it's to feed their kids and their family and all of this life that they've built based on the joys and sorrows of existence. And it that's where the real, I mean, not to be a damper on all that, but there is a problem with this pursuit of joy. And when you leave it behind, the Buddha said, the Bodhisattva said, for every desire that is let go, a happiness is won. He who would every happiness have must with all lusts be done. That's a
good point to end.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Venerable.
If anyone has other questions, I can stick around. I don't have to run away. So
we'll still be here if you want to have questions. But we will stop there, because some people have arranged to meet other people later on this evening. I'll just leave with a note as you go.